Welcome, everyone, to the Jake Dunlap Show. This is your weekly dose of real success stories from entrepreneurs, athletes, celebrities, CEOs, and the people that you love. If you've ever wondered what makes people tick, what are the weird things that happened to them in their past that helped to shape the people that they've became? Every Thursday at 8 a.m. Eastern, you can tune in and get exactly that. The behind the scenes, not the typical behind the scenes, but the real stories that shaped some of the people that you know, love, and follow. All right. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Jake Dunlap Show. Today's guest, this is going to be a fun one. We actually use his product and help to use it for our clients as well, too. So it's always fun when that happens. This gentleman, I mean, I would put this guy's like OG tech. I mean, you want to talk not like back in like using Commodore computers, like not that like OG. But, you know, when you think about, you know, growing up in the late 90s, you know, early 2000s, this guy has been, you know, programming, being a CTO for 20 plus years. You know, he founded a company that was wildly successful, ended up selling to Dell, and now is CEO of Guru. If you don't know Guru, it is a knowledge management solution. I think of it as, and how we use it as, like, it is the central net for your company where you can go and find and do everything. So if that doesn't give it away, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Rick Nucci. Rick, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jake. Wonderful setup. Very appreciated. I did not have a Commodore. I did have a Tandy 1000EX. We can talk more about that, but I'm definitely excited to be here.
Awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to it as well. So look, you know, just like every episode, if you're tuning in for the first time, you know, we focus on telling the stories of, you know, the things that shaped us and lessons that we learned that shaped us into the people who we are today. So, you know, Rick, why don't you take us back a little bit to Lancaster? I don't know if there's like a Pennsylvania way to say it. So you grew up in Lebanon, right outside of Lancaster. You know, what are some early memories you have around, you know, whether it's, you know, business, entrepreneurship, and, you know, what was life kind of like for you growing up then?
I feel lots of privilege and appreciation for how I was brought up and my parents, and I feel fortunate to have a great relationship with both of them. I think one of the things that inspired me, or maybe was just planted in my brain from a young age, is both of my parents were entrepreneurs. And they both ran businesses for most of my years growing up. And so that was a very normalized thing that I think when I later got to the point of deciding to start Boomy, just felt very natural, like a thing that's normal to do, you know, that sort of thing. And there was a thing that both of my parents would instill in me that I've taken to today and has so resonated with me. And the phrase they would use is, hey, remember that person puts their pants on the same way you do, one leg at a time. And, you know, when you're a kid, you're like, what? Why are we talking about pants? But like, over time, I was like, got it, right? Remembering that we're all humans and our accomplishments are wonderful and they are great. But at the end of the day, we are all humans. And that is just something that has stayed with me and has inspired a lot of how I think personally and how I like to treat and interact with people around me. And I would really credit that to their thinking as something that's like stayed with me.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's interesting, you know, I get people are kind of a mix of, you know, CEOs who came from, you know, their parents were in academia or something, and then others that were, you know, entrepreneurs. And it's just like, well, yeah, this is like a normal thing. And what types of businesses were your parents running?
They were both what we would today call bootstrapped. I don't think that word was used maybe back then, but
it's called a profitable small business, Rick. It's this crazy thing called a profitable business. And like, we put a label of bootstrapped. Anyway, I digress.
Eyes rolling hard. Yeah, exactly. So my dad's business was basically manufacturing awards. It was so, grew up in Lancaster, Lebanon, Amish country, a lot of horse equestrian things going on. So like medals, trophies for horse shows. Later that became like medals for like marathons and races. And I mean, you see some of those medals now, they're like these big, beautiful, elaborate things. Like they would make those and sell those. And my mom ran a retail gift store in sort of the local mall through middle school and high school.
That's great. Did your dad ever make up any medals for you? Did he ever like make up any like best son ever or like second hardest worker in the family or something like that?
That is such a great question because, you know, I was the kid who grew up and was like really tall, but like lanky and awkward. I'm still as an adult tall, lanky and awkward. But as I was growing up, it was like, oh, basketball. This kid's going to play basketball. Everyone I talk, you play basketball, right? You're playing basketball. So I'd be like, I guess I play basketball. I was never good at basketball. I was never good at anything sports related, right? When I sort of hit ninth grade, I hit this fork in the road and I veered hard right into the world of music. I started learning guitar, started getting into all that. But to your question, I remember, you know, all my friends are like excelling in sports because I made a lot of friends through playing basketball, but I was never good at it, right? But like all my friends are playing, they're excelling, they're doing good, they're great, you know, and absolutely what you just said happened. Really, it was my mom I am my mom's only child. So maybe a bit of a coddling going on, maybe a bit of a Bev from Meet the Goldbergs situation a little bit. Made me this like basketball thing. And it like now I'm like, it's sweet, right? At the time I was like, oh God, like really? I like just this feeling of like, I don't deserve this medal, but it's amazing that you asked because yes, that absolutely happened.
I love that. Yeah, of course she did. She's like, you know, all right, we've got to do this. Okay, so you got the medal. What was the medal titled, by the way? Was there like a name for it? Or is it just like best basketball player?
It wasn't. It actually didn't say anything. It was actually really cool what it was. I'll tell you what it was. It was so when the sneaker celebrity athlete thing started emerging, obviously Air Jordans was the big thing. But like my family is all from Boston. So we were all Celtics, Larry Bird, that whole crew. I had the Larry Bird black Converse and they actually took one of the Converse shoes. Like if I was a great basketball player, this would be an amazing thing to have, right? The problem is I didn't earn this, but it's such a cool idea, right? So the Larry Bird Converse, the shoe that I wore, they took one of them and they basically like, cause like they could literally make all kinds of stuff, right? They could make trophies and all these different things. They coated it in this like metallic thing and basically like hardened it into this almost imagine like a bronzed shoe. And that's what it was. And they gave that to me. And yeah, I was like, what a cool idea. Man, if only I was good at basketball, this would have really been a thing.
If only I was any good. It reminds me, yeah, in high school, I played basketball in high school and we had this kid, we had a 7 foot tall kid in our high school. And the best part is, so again, just, you know, tall, lanky, awkward. And the best part is he was in ROTC. So like, imagine like the pregame, right? You're doing the national anthem and the 7 foot kid, you're like, obviously that kid's playing. It's like, nah, he's in ROTC. So you just assume you're like this kid's seven. I mean, literally the guy was 7 feet tall. We forced him. There was a point I remember like we forced him like, dude, you have to at least come. And then like after a bit, you're like, okay, now I get it. So, all right. So you got this love for music. One thing I read I love is like your dream superpower is that you could just have the ability to pick up any instrument and be immediately proficient. I think a lot of people would wish for that as well, especially like college time, right? You can just whip out the piano or the guitar. Where did that come from? Like, where do you think, like, again, were your parents into music or what got you into that?
My parents are very much into music. I started listening to music as a young kid. I immediately connected to it. My parents inspired me with great stuff. They love Beatles. I love Elvis, but they also got into all of the, you know, the Bee Gees and the Beach Boys, like, and the deep track stuff too, right? Like the really interesting stuff. And then MTV came out. And I remember I'd hold my recorder up and like record the songs that were coming on MTV. And I just So I sort of had that love, right, forever. And then a couple of my friends started like writing songs and like doing things like that. One started learning keyboard. I started learning keyboard. I got a bass guitar. I got a guitar. So like it was sort of a friend generated thing. And it just sort of stuck and carried on and has, you know, stayed with me till today.
I love it. What was the name of that band? Like, what was the name of your first band?
We had a band. Our name was Manic Oppressive. Was the name of our band in high school.
So good. And it's pre-YouTube, so we probably can't find anything on YouTube.
No, you cannot, nor should you go look.
And so when did you get into DJing? Because that was another thing that you started to get into. And what I heard is like, was it primarily R&B? Or was it everything, you know, 90s and 80s?
It was heavy R&B, but we branched out. But the name, myself and my friend Bryce started DJing R&B. Yeah, I mean, the creativity is just off the charts. But I mean, that was really my first job. And so I started doing that when I was 15. I had a birthday party. I got some money for my birthday party. I bought like a household thing, household speakers, made some money, upgraded it to like legitimate, can like, you know, play in a big cafeteria or wedding or whatever. And I did all the high school dances starting in 10th grade. I would do weddings, and you know, I would charge, you know, $50 an hour at the time to DJ. And that's inexpensive for what a DJ charged. But for a 16-year-old kid, that's an uncalculable amount of money, right? So like I would get all, you know, it was like a real income, but it was a lot of fun. And in college, I sort of like veered away from it, but I love doing it because again, you're sort of like exploring music, you get your lineup. It was a lot of cassettes and then CDs when CDs became a thing, obviously way easier. And like, it was a good run. It was a lot of fun, but yeah, it was a lot of R&B. I mean,
well, look, I'm an R&B for those of you who know me. I'm a 90s R&B individual. So this is very near and dear to my heart. I was going to ask you this, like, what was your R&B like go-to? Like, what were some of like the, and I'm sure it evolved over time, but you know, it's the high school prom or whatever. What's the song that you're going to either like close it down with, or you know, is going to get everyone hyped?
I mean, Mary J. Blige, Bobby Brown, later MC Hammer when he was blowing up.
Too legit to quit. Hey, hey.
You got it. All of that. Boys to Men, Philly Proud, Boys to Men.
That's right. Yeah.
Those were huge.
Those were the go-tos.
Those were the go-tos that everybody loved and lit up over. Yeah.
That's right. We'll link to some of this for people. So, you know, I was a massive, I've seen Keith Sweat in concert 3 times now, maybe 4. Black Street, New Edition, whenever they got back together, that was a great reunion tour. Casey and JoJo. Oh, so good. 90s R&B.
It was a great age for R&B. It really was. I mean, there was so much. Yeah, that was probably 70% of my catalog was all of that.
I love it. Trust me, I can relate. So how did you get into? So you end up going to Penn State, not too far away. What point did you get into? I mean, you're majoring in logistics and supply chain, but then obviously, you know, you go in, you start to get involved in, you know, the world of tech. What point did you start to kind of get involved more in the, you know, technology and, you know, engineering side?
Yeah, totally. As I was like wrapping up, I mean, Penn State has like this amazing nationally recognized logistics and supply chain program. That's what got me into it. But as I was getting through it, I was like, you know, it's actually all the technology stuff that's happening, right? Like demand forecasting, supply chain planning, like those were the classes where I was like, this is fascinating stuff. And I started to figure out the common patterns. Like, yeah, this is the technical stuff. Like, this is the early days of enterprise software being, you know, leveraged by companies to make smart decisions. And that was the interesting stuff. And even just personally, like, I remember when CD Now launched, right? And you could go online and buy music and have it sent to your house. You know, that was huge. I remember sitting in the Penn State labs, you know, I didn't have a computer at the time where I could do that, and like going in there to use it to like buy CDs and send it to my house, right? So like I was like fascinated by all that stuff. I'm like, all right, well, I'm not gonna change majors, but hey, what if, you know, what if I really just took my, you know, there's sort of some paths, right? You could take logistics down, like literally going to a logistics company. I ended up joining a logistics software company, which oddly was based in Philadelphia. I say oddly because there were not a lot of software companies in Philadelphia in the year 2000. There were very, very few, but this was one of them. And so I was like, okay, great. This is a way to merge like my major with what I'm really passionate about. And that sort of got me in the door of like into the world of technology. And I joined the R&D team and I was doing QA. I went back to school and learned how to code. I never was great at coding, but I think it did help me understand better how the products that were being sold to these companies worked and that sort of thing. And it was sort of like never looked back from there.
Yeah, I think it's interesting just how these different choices, you know, and like random things. Did you also, for those of you who don't know, back in this time too, not only could you buy CDs online, you could also get this thing called Columbia House, okay? For those of you who don't remember Columbia House, this is like where you could get like the parental advisory stuff. Do you remember this? Where they would literally ship you like 10 CDs for like 5 cents. It was so great. And then you could literally not pay them because you were a kid. And oh my gosh, that's how I got like early Mystical before he joined No Limit and some other players. And I'm like if my parents found these, like, you know, my Montel Jordan CD, my, you know, like all my music back then was Columbia House. It was pretty great. For one penny, you got 10 CDs.
It was. I can't even tell you how that business model worked today because yes, I remember that. I remember getting stacks of CDs and I'm like, how am I getting this?
Why had they're just, again, like they don't care. They're like, oh, you had all this explicit side of like 14 or so, 13 or something, just shipping it in. Parents are like, here you go. Like not my, yeah. Like I also think about my parents. Like why is my, you know, high school son getting this package of things. You know, it's like my parents also, you know, I'll blame them for that too. But no, I'm glad they looked the other way. So you go to work for somebody for a little bit and then you start a company, you know, a few years out, right? So you kind of go back to school, you get kind of, you know, you understand kind of the tech side of it. And then you found Boomi. You know, what was it that you decided like, hey, I'm going to go out on my own? You know, what was that process like for you?
Totally. Yeah. So the problem that we saw, there were originally three of us that started Boomi, and the problem that we saw was every time this logistics software was deployed within these customers, there was this massive integration effort. And that is, you know, connecting that logistics system into SAP or whatever other software existed within the company. Hugely complex. It was always the reason that the deployments were late and customers were always upset. And it would always point back to integration. We're like, okay, well, what, you know, the way it was being solved then was writing custom code. You just go in and stitch together these systems and it's very brittle and fragile and it broke. And we're like, okay, well, what if we productize that? What if we build a way where you could connect these systems together and not have to, you know, write code to do it? And so that was the problem. And then was working at the same company with these two other guys. And we sort of got, you know, excited and we started talking about it. And we started talking about what if we could do it on our own and what if we could go out and solve this problem. And frankly, like the EXE Software was the name of the company at the time. They're now under the Infor umbrella, but like, hey, what, you know, they probably would be partners of ours and when we could go and do this. And so that we did that, and that started in March of 2000. So I was only there for 2 years. So I was 24 when that started, and the three of us kind of launched out and began.
And what are some early memories you have, or like big lessons from like the first half of scaling? Because eventually 2010, you end up selling to Dell and you know, you're going to stay for a little bit. But what are some things that you remember early on or lessons learned around, you know, kind of the initial scaling of the business?
Yeah, there was, in a lot of ways, there was kind of two Boomis, is how I always talk about it. And there's the Boomi that those that are familiar with the company would know today. And that is the cloud, you know, what people will call an integration platform as a service. Boomi one, I learned a ton of, you know, painful, but in now in hindsight, very valuable lessons. And so like the first one was like founder conflict. Really rough. I mean, that, you know, by, I said we started in 2000. By 2003, I was the only founder left. There was a lot of strife and conflict. I think if I were to summarize two points of learning, like number one, I would never start a company and not have clarity around, for lack of a better word, who the CEO is. Well, a better way to say it is like,
yeah,
who's the ultimate decision maker? Because we walked in and we're like, we're fine. We'll make all these decisions, everything. It'll be unanimous. And as soon as we hit a conflict, we're like, uh-oh, now what? Like, who decides, you know? And like,
right.
That was a mess and a lot of pain and a lot of just wasted time having internal conversations that weren't actually like solving problems for customers. And then related to that too is we all had the same skills. Like we all came into the company and came out of the R&D. You know, we were all engineers, QA, like we were all just the people that had these kind of like redundant skill sets. And so we didn't complement each other as well as I think we could have. And that caused problems around like who's working on what, right? So yeah, by 2003, you know, I was the only one left. We had a really truest in the sense of the word angel investor, Mike West, who wrote the first check into the company in 2000. He was a CIO. He lived the pain personally of integration. So he got what we were doing. He wrote the first check into the company. He would join as interim CFO, and he played so many roles in keeping that company, you know, stable and on sound footing. He was a mentor to me, taught me a ton, but like really helped get the company to the place where we became what I would call Boomi 2.0, which became the reinvention. Oh, and the final thing I would say that got seared into my brain is like, we also set all those things aside, right? Like the early product of Boomi, we quickly realized there was like 50 of us. I mean, you had these bigger companies that were raising capital. Microsoft came out with a product called BizTalk, you know, maybe a year after we had started, that was really trying to do the exact same thing. You go and read their website and what they're doing and like, oh boy, who wants to be competing with Microsoft when you're a handful of people early stage with a product that doesn't have a clear, compelling differentiation? I remember walking into an investor's office with this like data sheet we had created, and we were all proud of it. We're like, look at this. We're going to use this to talk to our customers. And he looks at it and he's like, okay, so if you replace the word Boomi with, you know, this competitor right here and you read it again, would it be accurate? And we were like, oh, Like, it was so like, okay, we are so missing. And just what got seared into my brain is the idea of differentiation and the idea of how you make your approach unique and novel. And it's something that sounds very obvious to me now, but that's only because it was so burned into my brain then, something I took with me. So that was kind of the Boomi 1.0 chapter. Boomi 2.0 really applied a lot of that, you know, brought in another partner, a guy named Bob Mao, who came in. I sort of operated as CTO. He operated as CEO. Very complementary skill sets. I mean, he just was someone who had run software businesses for a while. He had a great eye at sort of like how to take a complicated technology and talk about it in a simple way. And, you know, we really sort of created, we literally called it Boomi 2.0, but it was a truly cloud native. It was a bet. And the bet was like truly a bet. It was like a burn the ships bet, right? It was like, okay, if the world is going to move to cloud, this is not a fad. If this is real, because you talk in 2006, we started on this path. And who was in the cloud then? Salesforce, NetSuite, handful of cloud companies back then. But if the world moves that way, the way these products connect together and get integrated is going to be fundamentally different than the way it's done in the on-premise world. So let's build a product for that future and literally rebuild it toward that. And we did that. And that is the Boomi that exists today. Of course, it's evolved a ton over the years, but that concept was what we shifted to and really changed the trajectory of the company as we launched it. And we started riding, you know, partnering with folks like Salesforce who really were driving, you know, every time they deployed, there was this integration problem and really kind of really propelled the company forward. And I feel fortunate through the pain, but feel fortunate in like really having that eye on the role innovation can play and really rethinking old problems in new ways. And it's ultimately something I look back on very fondly. Maybe not those early dark days, but ultimately very something I'm very happy about.
Well, I'm sure. And then what was the reason? I mean, like, what point did you decide to sell, or what point to, you know, get acquired?
Yeah, we had two partners come inbound. And, you know, if anyone's been in these conversations before, right, there's very different conversations, right? There's the corp dev folks who tire kick and look and see if they can get a deal. And then there's the, like, you know, co-founder of the company or number two. I remember Steve Felice at Dell, who was direct report to Michael Dell, ran all of SMB globally for Dell, like flew into Philly, sat in our office and met with us. We're like, okay, this is real. This is serious. This is something they really want to explore and talk about. And there was another company that was in a very similar spot. And through this process and through understanding what these folks wanted to do, what their vision was, we were like, boy, this feels like it's these inflection points I think a lot of founders face. It's like, okay, we could raise the next round of funding, or we could go down this path. And obviously we chose the path. But I think it was a really great example of, you know, where partnerships can authentically and organically lead to strategic outcomes. I say authentically and organically, like, I think it can be weird if you try to engineer it and try to build something that's like perfect for someone. There's kind of only one path, but like when partners really are an important part of your go to market, as it was the case in Boomi, became this very organic conversation where these guys were like, look, like, we need to own this. The integration's strategic enough for us. We need to own it. And so, like, what do you think? And we went down the path. And I always say Dell was a really fantastic acquirer, in a sense that they had done it a bunch of times, the process of acquiring, the process of integrating, and were just really thoughtful about it. And I look back on that too and think, like, wow, like, really sort of did everything they said they were going to do a post-acquisition. It's always a nervous time, right? But really, I think really did a nice job with the company.
Yeah, that's awesome. And obviously ended up being a great outcome for you. And he stuck with it past, you know, the 1.0. And I think sometimes it's, you know, you brought in a partner. I think some of the lessons, just kind of making some notes, it's, you know, I think sometimes it can be, whether it's ego or other things, where you're like, I can do it, I can figure it out. And I think, you know, sometimes you get to that point where you're like, look, I need to bring in someone. And then you bring it in and it's like, oh my God, like, what did I do before this? And so it sounds like, again, as you made that run, and how did that kind of impact? Obviously, Guru, I think, was, you know, kind of founded out of, you know, again, similar to how you on Boomi, or like the thing that you saw, right? You're like, hey, there's like a issue or gap here. What, you know, for you, when was it time to leave? And then how did you think about kind of going back and starting all over again?
Yeah, totally. The going back and starting all over, it was interesting because it was like, I had no exit plan out of Dell. I think they're full stop, right? And so it wasn't like I was necessarily looking to leave or there was a timeline. And they're obviously two very different jobs, running a business unit. You know, pretty quickly, my partner moved on and started another company, and I stayed on and ran the business of Boomi, you know, within Dell, reporting up to a VP at Dell, and just kind of like was doing that and learning a lot through that process. They're very different jobs. And really, it was when I became convinced of the problem. And I became convinced of the problem around knowledge sharing, knowledge management. First, when we tried to do it ourselves. So as we were growing Boomi, we tried setting up wikis, we tried setting up intranet sites. Nobody used them, basically. You'd set them up, there'd be a little fanfare, and then they would just kind of like fade into the background, and then the information would go stale, and then you sort of have this downward spiral of non-adoption. And I was like, boy, this seems important.
Yeah, it's living on someone's computer and they quit.
Yeah, that, yes, knowledge walks out the door with it, yes. And then when we were acquired by Dell, the need for that knowledge sharing went up tenfold, because now you're trying to enable, you know, product knowledge and positioning to a much broader organization beyond just Boomi. And, you know, they had things like intranet sites set up and just no one was using them, and there wasn't a way to do it. So what ended up happening, right? What ended up happening was me and my team were on countless calls, flying to countless places to do enablement work, right? To sort of do knowledge sharing, because there was no source of truth. There was no concept of self-service. And we're like, this is madness, right? And then I remember going to, sort of towards my end, I started building conviction for this. I'm like, how are there not products that are good at doing this? And I remember going to this Gartner event, and I remember sitting in this session with it was an intranet vendor in the session, or excuse me, the session was about an intranet vendor. The vendor was nowhere in the room, but it was about that intranet vendor. And there were five Gartner analysts sitting up on stage and a room full of people, and the session starts, and I'm sitting in the back to just listen and learn. And I start seeing the emotion of the room start to pick up, because these are people who own the intranet within these companies, and it's not going well, and people aren't using it, and they're standing up and they're asking questions to Gartner, and they're raising their voices, and they're like, when's this going to change, and when will we have that? And, you know, the poor Gartner analysts are up there like getting hammered, like they're the vendor, and like they're not, you know. It was wild. And I walked out of that session and I'm like, I have to start this company, like, with that much emotion and energy in the room about a product that had many, many, you know, many hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue, and that amount of dissatisfaction. I'm like, this seems like there's something here. And that sort of like, that was the tipping point. So I was at Dell for almost 3 years. I did kind of a 4-month transition. I didn't want to rush out. I wanted to make sure Boomi was like in a good place by the time I had left. I had a great successor who was running product at the time, named Chris McNabb, who was Boomi's CEO for 10 plus years after I left, did a phenomenal job growing the business. So that, you know, sort of shored all of that up, and then started Boomi, and started it with my co-founder, Mitch Stewart, who was running engineering at Boomi. So he had been through all those dark days at Boomi and was our first, what I call, professional engineer who went on and built a lot of the hard stuff at Boomi, and then built a team around him and ran engineering. And so I couldn't have thought of a better kind of like partner to go on the guru journey with. And so he left Boomi/Dell with me to start in end of 2013, 2014.
Yeah, that's great, man. And yeah, if you guys don't know, we'll link to Guru as well. Like I said, we actually use it for a lot of our sales consulting and implemented it just for a client, I guess maybe a few months ago, for a medium-sized sales team. So it's a really strong product as well. And so this is kind of, you know, kind of your second time around, right? So what are the things that you feel like the second time around that you've nailed, or maybe some of like the early learnings of like doing it the second time around where you repeated your mistakes?
I've certainly done that. I would say things that didn't feel any easier: pricing. I think pricing is like, getting pricing right is like as hard as like actually building the product. They were very different challenges at Boomi than they were at Guru, but hard. I would say the journey of getting to product market fit also didn't feel any easier at Guru than it did at Boomi, in that you are someone, I think it was David Cancel at Drift had this awesome analogy that always stuck with me. I heard him say it like 5 years ago. He's like, when you don't have product market fit, imagine you're standing in a desert and you're trying to see product market fit. So you walk through the desert. Well, are you actually walking deeper into it, or are you walking out towards the oasis and the water and the trees, right? And the thing is, you don't know, right? Because you know, no one knows your brand. No one really cares about what you do. To get businesses to buy any software, period, is hard because it's just hard because it takes change and all of these things, right? And that was just a hard journey. I think things that we really centered on that were, you know, strengths of building a business would be around what I would call culture. Everybody calls it culture, but like what I would really frame around, like, how do you actually define your culture through a set of written values that you bring to life in your company and really kind of like maniacally reinforce through company rituals and things like that. And I think that's been something we've centered on. I think Boomi had accidentally good culture in that I think we hired well. I think we hired people that sort of ascribed to certain cultural identities we wanted. I think at Guru, we were more intentional and eventually, you know, learned how to build a talent team that would also look to help find people that were connected and compatible with our company values and that sort of thing. And so I think that one was probably good. I think there was probably a lot of things around scaling and around how, thinking about raising venture capital, which was something we had done at both companies, that felt way easier, at Guru. Starting two companies in Philadelphia, one being in 2000, one being in 2013, world of difference. I think it went from, if you're not in Silicon Valley, then that's an objection you have to immediately overcome. And then New York became another tech hub, but Philly wasn't. And, you know, fast forward to today, Excel led our last Series C round and would actually say, like, we think it's great to actually back companies that aren't in tech hubs. We think there's actually an inherent advantage. Of course, now it's all changed again. You know, now the idea of like, what does a tech hub mean in a world where so many people are working remote and hybrid and choosing, you know, starting more and more to choose where they live based on where they want to live versus where their job is. That's all changing. But at the time, just that, what it was like building in a non-tech hub was, I think, something that became a hard objection to, in the Guru journey, honestly, probably a strength and an opportunity that we took advantage of.
And again, obviously with the pandemic, et cetera, that kind of increased even, I think, the need for people to, you know, have tools like a Guru to connect and stay on top of things, you know, where again, you can't just go over to someone's desk and it's like, what's that thing again? Or like, how do I do that? Or whatever. So I'm sure that was a, you know, kind of interesting few years. And you know, as we start to wrap up here in a little bit, I'm curious if we kind of shift gears a little bit to kind of the world that you're seeing now. So I can imagine, like, you know, the pandemic kind of accelerated people wanting to, you know, have and really understand the importance of some of these tools. How do you see that kind of shaping the future of how people work? And you know, I've talked to a lot of different guests who have played different parts in this about that question. What are some of the big trends that you're seeing and, you know, things that get you excited?
I think there's this like phenomenal opportunity where we can take the best parts of what it was like working in an office, combine that with the best parts of what we're learning about working remote and create the ideal experience. That's the opportunity.
All right. I want to learn this. Okay. Right. I'm running a smaller 45 plus person company. And, you know, we were already kind of fairly remote. We were already probably 80% remote, but for the people out there that, like, you know, are in it or maybe working at a company too, and just want to, you know, help. How do you do that? You know, how do you stay connected without the happy hours and guest bartenders? And, you know, like, what are the real things that you do to create that glue?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I'll start with maybe some harder times, right? I think in the pandemic, forget that we all shifted to remote. It's not just that we went to remote work. We did, obviously. And that shift has long remained. And I think people will call it hybrid. People will call it remote. I think the idea that 9 to 5, Monday through Friday office is the norm has effectively gone away from what it was. So if you sort of think about that, the first thing, at least what we felt inside of Guru, was the connectedness. And let's start at the company level, right? Like, how do we communicate what is going on to people in a succinct way? And I think what we all did in the beginning is we all recreated all of our office rituals. Like, we just remain synchronous. We remain live. So we're like, all right, well, we're just going to do all the stuff we did, but now we'll do it over Zoom. And then when we need to talk to each other, we'll just use messaging products and we'll just sort of recreate all that and nothing will change. And I think now people are going, well, wait, why are we doing that? Because it's actually not better. You know, that alone is not actually better because Zoom fatigue, Zoom burnout, these things are very real. They everyone experiences some version of that, right? And so I think that has led to truly starting to look at these rituals and start to be intentional about being asynchronous. And so when you're communicating something, do you have to gather everyone in a room, physical or virtual anymore, and talk about it live at a time when everyone happens to be available, when people are in different time zones and different places? What if instead you had a brief 15-minute update that was delivered via text or video? And, you know, of course we use Guru for that, but regardless, like, let people consume that as they want and engage in that as they want, right? Like keep people informed through different techniques instead of just the live in-person town hall that everyone has to gather around, which is in many ways kind of a monologue oftentimes. How could you actually change that, right? So that's a great one. How is a decision made, right? That's a great one. I mean, you can see companies like Amazon that are famous for having the like written memo and like ways they have asynchronous decision making built in. But for a lot of us, that wasn't really a thing. But imagine now taking the process of how you make a decision within your team and going, do we need to be in the room together to make that decision? Or can I actually write a decision doc, send it to you and go, Jake would love your feedback on that. You'll comment on that. When we actually meet together, we're like 90% of the way done because we had so many turns in an asynchronous format together that when we actually sat down together and talked, like, it was kind of just sealing it, right? And that has been an amazing boost in effectiveness for our team and kind of getting that going. But
what do you all use for that? Yeah, what do you use to do that? I think we've started to do this internally quite a bit, and I noticed the same thing where it was like I think you also had a group of people that because they really liked the in office and they liked bumping in and random, that kind of created this over meeting culture. It's like, and I think it's like they're just having the meetings because they're like, you know, because they're somewhat lonely, and it's very real. You know, it's like, well, let me hop on the call. It's like, no. Send it. We use a tool called Vidyard to do the videos, but you know, internally there's Loom. There's, you know, obviously you can do some of the stuff in Guru too. How do you do that collaboration without being in a meeting? I think, you know, I'm very selfish in asking this, but I think a lot of people out there are like, hell yeah, if I can get out of some meetings, man, I'm in. So like, how do you see companies effectively collaborating? I mean, there's the asynchronous kind of updates and communications, but true, you know, whether it's brainstorm or collaboration, how do you see companies doing that really effectively now?
Totally. Yeah. I think there's a couple of ingredients. I think there's written documents, which could be anything from a Google Doc to, you know, a tool of choice of document, right? But that document is not the result. That's the collaborative, let's figure it out and get to the result. Loom for asynchronous video, absolutely. Figma, Miro, Mural for the canvas, if that's needed.
Yeah, we use Mural too, yeah.
Yep, absolutely. Slack for conversations around all of that. And then when it is a decision that has been made, you memorialize that in Guru. So some place that is designed for the one to many distribution of that once it is a, in fact, confirmed decision. It could be, yeah, and here's how this feature is going to work. And so we need to write that and prepare for the launch of the feature, whatever it might be. But you can imagine this collaborative set, and you get to the end of it and you have these assets at the end. You want to manifest those assets to be distributed out to the broad team. But your question is really like, okay, well, getting up to that decision. Yeah, I think those are the tools that I think are emerging that are playing these vital roles in allowing people to do this collaboration. You know, I'm working on someone with a coworker right now, and we're using Figma, and we've never met live on this thing we're working on right now. And I send it, and she'll send me something back, and she'll use a Loom to explain what she's doing. And then by the end of it, it's done. We never actually talked live. And it was sort of like, as we both had time, we'd go back and forth. And I think it's early days, but I think that's like an amazingly powerful opportunity for us to kind of get right. And I also want to go back to the in-office thing, because you talked about the happy hours, the team building. I think the other thing we don't want to forget is it's not a binary thing. I think that we can truly figure out like what is work best done in person, what is work best done at home, and how do we optimize towards that. Before the pandemic, everyone was complaining about open office floor plans. Like you go back and Google it, right? Like that was the problem then. Everyone's like, oh my God, it's too noisy. I wear headphones.
Oh, that was like the productivity killer, right? They kind of found out that we thought it was really cool and it sucked.
Yes, exactly, right? So like that was a big problem that now everyone's going back to work. But I think to your point about the human connection, it's real. Absolutely. And so I don't think the answer either is like no one ever sees each other, right? But if you imagine a place where we can have an intentional workplace strategy where we're designing that work, there are teaming agreements where they're saying, hey, when we're doing a design heavy thing, we want to be standing in a room together and we want to do this together. We want to do team building. We want to go to dinner together. Like we have to make space for that. While also, hey, without a doubt, for certain in the zone, deep focus tasks, if I'm sitting at home or wherever I'm sitting where I'm alone, I'm going to get that done 2-3 times as fast. I mean, without a doubt, right? So I think that's what I mean when I say we have this opportunity to combine the best of both, where we can go, what was great about when we sat in an office? What's great about when we're remote? How do we really bring the best of those things together? I think we can do something really amazing here. But again, like some of the headlines, right? When you start branding this topic as employee friction or employees are threatening to leave because they don't have flexibility, you're doing this like management against employee. It's this unnecessarily dramatized thing. What does everybody want? Every employee wants to be effective. Every company leader wants their company to be successful. We want the same thing. I think we should just stop making it about this, like, it's this battle. It doesn't have to be. Right? It can be something where we recognize how can we make our team as effective as they can be. And it's through these combinations, right? So I think there's a great opportunity. I think we kind of need to change the narrative a little bit and recognize that there's a lot of goodness that can happen here, honestly.
Yeah. I think that it's such a good call out. And I think too, it's also, I think if you're not in leadership potentially, I would say, I think you'd be surprised at being overly communicative up and just letting people know like, hey, this is how I prefer, like what I'm into. I think more and more people need to speak up and just be very clear too about how they want to work remote as opposed to assuming that people are like them. And so as we kind of wrap up now, again, the kind of the last question, and you answered part of it, what are the things that you're most excited about looking forward? That's personal life, professional world, like what are kind of the trends or thing that you're most excited about?
Yeah, I mean, if I can, I think I'll just play off that point you just made, because I thought it was such a wonderfully important point. Like if I were to distill like my 8 years of guru and be like, what's one thing you would say within the category and the problems we solve, and not just guru, but broadly around collaboration and knowledge management, it's what you just said. When companies treat an initiative around collaboration, employee engagement, when they treat that as a product and they recognize that their employees are their internal customers and they just ask them what they want, to your point, the employees will not be shy. They will share what they want and they will tell you if they are happy with collaboration. They will tell you if they can find the information they need to do their jobs or not. They will tell you. You don't have to guess. And if you design answers to that are rooted in the things they are asking for, your company will perform better. But there is this weird propensity too often where you do this like force feed. I'm going to top down this onto the team and I'm going to do this forced adoption. And I can tell you every single time, immediately when you talk to companies and you see which one they are, you can predict success and you can predict failure 100%. And so I would just say like, the more you can just ask your employees, use EMPS surveys, use employee engagement mechanics to pull out of the team, they will tell you. And the nuggets that they will tell you are gold because they're living it every day. And when you give them what they want, they will perform better. Your company will perform better. And it's a beautiful thing.
I think it's a great point. And I think for a lot of people, you know, I see people leave jobs because of this stuff as well too, and I would just, you know, you can shape, I think people can shape a lot more of the experience they want at work if they just pick their head up. Sure, there's bad companies, but I kind of tend to believe that most leaders are actually deep down pretty good people and want the best for everybody. And I think there's such an opportunity now in particular to really think and take a step back after this podcast, if you're listening here at the end, and just say, what do I want my work experience to be like? And I think I'm just seeing more and more people ask themselves that question and get exactly what they want. And so I think it's a really, really great point and a great one to wrap up on. So Rick, big thank you for joining me, man. It was a lot of fun. We could just do a whole nother episode just chopping it up about like top R&B songs of the 90s and debate.
I'm in.
Was Blackstreet overrated? You know, what about 702? You can't sleep on 702. We can go deep on it. People are like, well, who the hell are these people? But look it up. You'll see it.
Yeah. It seems like some live music might be in our future too. That seems like a to-do for me and you. Yeah.
I love that, man. I'm into it. I'll hit it. I'll hit you up, man, the next time something comes through. So, look, really enjoyed it. Appreciate all of you for tuning in. And we'll see you next week on the Jake Dunlap Show. Thank you, everyone, again for listening to another episode. If you are listening all the way to the end, I hope you have left a review. I hope that you make sure that you're following or subscribing on your favorite podcast listening apparatus. We'll be back next Thursday. And again, make sure to check out the Monday episodes as well, too. A lot of people are really enjoying these kind of mini episode Mondays. So make sure to tune in, subscribe, and leave a review.